Okay, welcome everybody. This is our first podcast with Smart Futures. And my name is Jim Petrosini, and I'd like to thank everybody for joining. With me today is Dr. Marv Langston and Ken Tierman. Marv, would you like to do a little intro?
Sure. My background is military and Defense Department, and mostly in the new technology area, trying to figure out what we can do to outfit our forces with the technology that'll satisfy the needs. And I've been doing a blog site for several years where I try to capture some of the issues related to technology adoption or acquisition. And Jim and I recently decided that, you know, maybe we ought to try to expand this out into a webinar format and try and bring in a lot of the very smart people we know to share a few ideas about some of these issues. And so I thought this would be a good start with Ken. We've known Ken for a long time, and he's an excellent engineer and excellent person that's been working in the same field with us for these years. And so we wanted to have a general topic today and just explore global ideas. What's going on, global perspectives? How do we feel about where the world sits today, both in terms of national security or even other things like world population, feeding the world, and working on whether or not this green new economy is the way we need to run the world. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ken for a minute.
Well, thank you very much, Marv and Jim. I appreciate the invitation. It's an honor to be your first guest. As Marv mentioned, I've been in this industry for many years, since 1982. Working in the defense industry and new technology, and some of which my work has involved Marv and technologies that he's been involved in. I've spent more time on providing services and solutions to customers in the industry, not as much as an advisor or consultant, and Marv's much better at that. But it's an honor to be here, guys, and I'm excited for this conversation.
Yeah, and I just want to preference, I actually did a podcast with Cal State San Marcos in the fall to kind of get up to speed on all this. So we got some good lessons learned from them. So this will help set up to Smart Futures. Marv, kind of what are the main objectives of Smart Future, and, you know, not just the blog, but, you know, the intent here with some of our topics?
Yeah, I thought it would be useful to try and set this webinar up so that we could explore all these interesting topics that we tend to like to talk about on our own, but do it in a way that we could capture it and share it with others, and including bring some of these other folks forward to have a conversation with us and let that conversation be recorded so that we can then share it out to other people and get other people to comment on it and even add other ideas about things that maybe we should talk about. So the whole idea is to come up with interesting ideas, talk about important topics of our time, and then keep it recorded so that we can allow it to be played back for other people.
Yeah, and our intent here is to have both kind of the webinar version that will be up on a YouTube channel that will have various links on various mediums like LinkedIn and Marv's blog. And then we'll also have through anchor.fm, we'll have it as a podcast, whether you're using Apple Podcasts or Spotify. So look forward to that and building kind of a base of listeners. So first topic for Ken, Marv.
Yeah, so why don't we get into it with Ken? I asked Ken and I got into a conversation a couple of weeks ago, and I said, well, that's pretty interesting because we sort of got into a very broad discussion about global perspectives. And so I said, let's use that for our first podcast, because it'll at least, we can start from the very, very broad areas and we can dig down into deep areas as we choose to. So Ken, let me just let you start it and talk about it. Why do we need global perspectives in this particular time and age? You know, what is it that's causing us to think about these things?
Well, the first thing that came to mind is, I think history teaches us that having a global perspective is always beneficial. Societies, civilizations that were global fare much better. I mean, I can countless examples, the merchants of Venice, the British Empire, Rome, right? When we think globally, we broaden our perspectives, it gives us more opportunities to profit and to cooperate with others in the globe. So any time is a good time to think globally. I think to answer the question specifically now, this maybe is deep, a bit of a deep dive right away, but we have a challenge with global balance of power right now. And I'm afraid that we're not taking a global perspective, and we should be taking more of a global perspective on what's happening in the Western Pacific specifically, and in the Eastern Bloc countries. I think back to our isolationist position as the United States prior to World War II, and we allowed Axis powers to grow unchecked till it became a world war problem. We should have done something sooner, and we didn't. We may be faced with that same challenge here today, right? So I turn it over to you for your perspective here, but that's a perfect example of a conversation we can have specifically about China and what's happening in the South China Sea and our reaction to it.
Well, what you made me think of when you were talking, Ken, is we live in a world today that's operating in at least seconds and milliseconds, if not nanoseconds and picoseconds, depending on what you want to talk about, right? And that world is so different than the world of the past, like the world you mentioned. It reminds me of, if you look at the Barbary Pirates situation when Jefferson was the president of the United States, we were in a war with Tripoli for 30 days before he ever found out about it, because they declared war against us, and that was how slow communication was back in those days. You had to get a letter written, sailed across the Atlantic. So obviously that's not the situation today. And if you look at these new satellite constellations that are going up with Elon Musk's SpaceX or Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin constellations, they're talking about 20 millisecond delays from Earth to space to communicate worldwide, wherever you want to go, because those satellites link themselves across the whole world. And rather than have an internet in the cities where we have it today, we're going to have massive bandwidth for everything that we do in the cities across every place on the planet, the oceans, the deserts, the mountains, everywhere. Mm-hmm. What do you think about this, Jim?
Well, I think Jefferson didn't have a Twitter account, right? So definitely, I think one of the issues is, are we training our leadership to know international business and international affairs? Or are we finding like the new leadership, or even in the military, is there a lack of understanding of, you know, just not foreign countries, but just, you know, history, and we, you know, everything we read, we tend to try to get rid of our old history, right? And I've always been a believer that history is very important to understand what you do in the future.
Well, that reminds me that this current cancel culture of trying to erase our own U.S. history is, I think, a very big mistake, and it will come back to roost for us in the future. But another thing you reminded me of as you think about that is how do our leaders really understand and think about this future when we've lived in, all of us people that are grown up that are currently alive on in our country have lived with our country being the greatest country on the planet, having the control and power of every other country on the planet to the degree that we chose to exercise it. And there's relatively few people who believe that that power can ever actually be exercised against us in a way that would be detrimental to ourselves and our society and our homeland.
Yeah, the first 30 pages of Kill Chain that I just started, right, is we've lost every war game in the last 5 to 10 years, and not many people know that, right? And that's kind of an eye opener.
Yeah. It goes beyond just this one topic. We're so tightly integrated globally, not thinking globally, our leaders not thinking globally, can have detrimental effects in other areas of our lives. As you know, we are concerned about the temperature of the planet, right? this, I don't want to get off too much of a tangent too quickly, but farmers in Brazil need to feed their families, right? And we sit back on our high and mighty and say, you shouldn't cut down the Brazilian rainforest because we need it to maintain our planet. But this poor guy needs to feed his family. So our global perspective has to take into consideration many, many factors. And to your point, Jim, I don't think our leaders can be expert on all these topics. We don't have a political system that elevates the most intelligent people, not necessarily. We have a political system, then you get elected for other reasons. And we depend on experts as advisors. That's why we have lobbyists. I know that they're often maligned, but our political leaders need experts in all these different fields to advise them. The challenge is the amount of information, the amount of challenge we have over the globe. It's overwhelming, right? How do you deal with all of these issues? And to Mark's point, the pace of technology is outpacing our ability to comprehend it and to deal with it, right? So are we going to depend on supercomputers to make decisions for us in the future? Because that's kind of what it looks like. We're heading that direction because of the amount of how fast things move and the amount of information that needs to be processed.
Yeah, we have a future topic. I think we're calling it machines and minds, or robots and brains. But you know, we definitely want to have a topic about the future of AI and machine learning and how it's going to interact with the human mind. And some of the recent work we're doing with just command and control, like is a human going to actually push the button on a ship in 5 to 10 years, or is it going to be an algorithm or a playbook that just gets run because of a certain scenario? So
you can have another topic altogether on ethics of all these things,
because yes,
that brings up another challenge, right?
Yeah, the ethics of algorithms, right? So what about the Roman Empire syndrome? Are we stuck in believing that we're a superpower and there's no other threat? And how do you get rid of that? You know, again, the term Roman Empire, or it's hard to change what we think and how we do things. And any thoughts on that?
I actually think it's a good analogy. And I also use the term Britain too as another analogy, because if you think about it, Rome eventually failed because they got lazy, overly confident that nothing could change their situation. They basically lost the morals of their society to a large degree, and eventually the big machines that they used as their war machines were decided by the outside folks from the German tribes and other places that didn't have the technologies, ways to cause those big machine technologies to fail. And we have the very same situation facing us today, if you look at it, because just one example, cybersecurity is a way for poor countries, poor organizations to penetrate our organizations and change the game. And they're doing it in spades in full time, because we are currently in a cyber war. We've been in cyber war since the late 90s. And we can't do anything about it overt, really, because it's so easy for people that are attacking us to mask themselves. And likewise, we're not sure that we can be sure who the attackers are because of the complexities of cybersecurity. And just one other example I'll bring up, which we could kick around. There's a book called One Second After. I forgot the author. I can look it up. But it's about what happens if three nuclear weapons were lit in the exact proper orbit above our country to create an electromagnetic pulse large enough to significantly destroy all the electronics below it. And the book is written by people that were participating in the EMP commission for the country and who've been working on this problem for years and years. And to this date, we have chosen not to spend the approximately $2.5 billion that we need to secure the grid from an EMP. So if you think about it, $2.5 million in today's budgets are round-off air. We don't even talk about $2.5 billion at the national level. And yet we will not secure our electromagnetic grid, I mean, our electric grid, such that an EMP could destroy everything that drives today. So in this particular book, the scenario, the first thing that happens is all the cars quit running. So the whole freeways just stopped and nobody knows why the freeways stopped. But of course, all the cars use modern computers, and modern computers are the first things that pop when an EMP goes out. And then you can't pump gas, you can't run the air conditioning, you can't run the hospitals. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And the end of the book, the net result of the book is within 1 year before they could get the power back on in the country, we lost 2/3 of the population, mostly due to internal wars with ourselves.
Right? Yeah, it was so, the speaker was at Qualcomm about 3 years ago, and I guess Newt Gingrich had him write the book to try to educate not only the Congress, but the Senate, and it got like very like deaf ears. Nobody really wanted to like believe it or understand it.
You mentioned asymmetric, in the context of war, asymmetric warfare. Be honest, we've had this challenge for a long, long time. In fact, we were the ones doing it to the British in our revolution, right?
But if you recall, the revolution.
Yeah. We were the ones using asymmetric warfare. We forget these things. We don't learn from our lessons. In Vietnam, it was used against us, right? The Middle East, asymmetric warfare is a huge challenge for us. Back to Jim's point earlier, I don't see us learning from history, whether it be this topic on EMT or our potential adversaries on the globe. I don't see us learning from history. But we seem to repeat errors over and over again.
So let me introduce another interesting topic that relates. A guy named Jeff Hawkins has written a couple of books about the brain, and he's got a new book out. I just started reading it. It's called 1,000 Brains, and he's one of the brain theorist thinkers. He's also a techie, and he's been trying to help develop neural networks and chips that will support neural network processing to help mimic the brain and therefore help support artificial intelligence kinds of things. But what he says in this new book is he says we basically are built around hundreds or thousands of brains, and these brains are competing with each other. And at the very basic level, we have our reptilian brain that tries to keep our body alive and keep us out of harm's way. And we have our mammalian brain that is causing us to try and think about what we're doing. So one of the early examples was the reptilian brain wants to go find food or sugar, that anything it can find to eat. And the mammalian brain says, no, don't eat sugar. It's not healthy for you, because we know that now, right? So the point of, I think, to bring that back to the discussion, what I've always thought about relative to the way countries react and over time is very similar to the way people react, right? So if you take a family or a person who is poor and he's striving to get rich and he becomes a big industry magnate of some kind and becomes rich, his family right behind him comes up, they may do pretty well, and they may carry the company forward and do well for a while, but the families that come up underneath those families start to tend to lose the interest, or they go off and they become artists, or they become musicians, or they do something that's not part of what that business industry was all about, and they start to lose it all, and then so they become trust fund babies, and they live on the trust fund until the trust fund eventually runs out, and that business base goes away or is surpassed by another business base. So I think we see that in families. I think we see it in countries. And I think maybe we see it in the world. I don't know.
So let me kind of tangent that comment, kind of like future leaders. You know, we go in cycles. We've had a few presidents or former military. I spent 3 months reading the U.S. Ulysses S. Grant book, which was like 1,300 pages, but you know, the guy was brilliant, right? But, you know, we had Eisenhower in the 50s. Where do our future leaders come from? Just say in the next 20 to 30 years, are they pure politicians where they have no military background or even no international or you know, the you know, do we get another actor like Ronald Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger? Do we get more Silicon Valley people that have so much money they have an influence? Do we have a Jeff Bezos who, you know, owns the Washington Post? Just some thoughts on what you guys see from the future leaders, and then maybe how the military academies, what their role plays in the next 20 to 30 years.
I think it would be a mistake for us to concentrate on any one type of background for our leaders. I think we've had mixed results, whether it be a military person or a pure diplomat. I think what's critically important, it goes back to what we talked about earlier, what's critically important is whether or not our leaders are intelligent enough to do the right thing, make the right decisions, and wise enough to listen to the experts, right? You can't know everything. And, you know, Ronald Reagan, while he was a politician and an actor first, turned out to be a pretty good leader. What are the qualities of an individual like that, right? Nixon, incredibly flawed individual, but he did some really great things, and he's forgotten. People think of him and remember Watergate, but if you recall, detente was his doing, right? And probably
he opened up China.
What's that?
He opened up China.
Yeah. So I don't know that there's an exact formula, but I certainly believe it has a lot to do with whether or not you're open-minded enough and wise enough to listen and learn, right? And to be honest, I question whether or not the direction we're going with the divisiveness in this country, whether or not we're going to have a future leader that's going to have those qualities. I think the divisiveness is going to show up in the executive office. So we've seen a little bit of that. So that's a hard question to answer, Jim.
Yeah. So the impact of social media, I have a 24-year-old, you know, who Instagrams at least five times a day, right? And has to check her Instagram account. How's social media and the future leadership with just the young culture today of the generations that are growing up? Again, how does that have an impact? I mean, is it more important that you have 3,000 followers to become a congresswoman or congressman versus knowledge? Just some thoughts on that.
Well, let's just talk about the education system for a while. I didn't pay a lot of attention to the education system as I was going through my work career life, because I just assumed that it was going to be sort of like the education I received. But turns out it isn't like the education I received, because we've now almost universally eliminated the social studies arts knowledge in our schools, our high schools, and even in our universities. And so we have people that are doing all of these creditable classes that are built around a seminar of some subject, like whether or not we should be more open-minded about transvestites or transgenders or, you know, whatever. So these kids today think much, much more about what's going on in these social contexts than they do about what the history lessons have taught us about the way civilization evolves and the way people always treat each other with respect to wars that are not going to go away.
Yeah,
I'll stop there for a minute and let you guys comment, but I think that that's one of the alarming signs that's on our horizon right now.
I don't disagree. Our education system may be failing us. I think while we tell ourselves that we're diverse, in reality, I think there's becoming a singular mind in the education system, and we don't have a broad enough perspective in the education system. And that's what I'm seeing. To Jim's point about technology, we had the expectation, we had the hopes that technology was going to help us to become more enlightened, to be more higher educated, right? Unfortunately, this focus on social media and the topics you mentioned, Marv, we're creating a future class of leaders that are more concerned with social status and how we're perceived in the world, as opposed to the things that matter. So that's why we see, you know, our tweeting and our Facebook pages being consuming people, because we think that's what's important. I think it's a huge challenge.
Yeah, it comes back to, well, to, just to mention another thing that happened in our school systems that I'm completely against, and I think it's coming to roost with us right now, is if you've ever listened to that guy, Mike Rowe, who's worried about the fact that we stop all of the trades lessons and learning in our schools. So we have school kids now that are all taught they need to go out and have a college degree. And so then we compounded that problem by saying everybody could have loans to get their college degree. So we get these kids that really should be in the trades business one way or the other, going into college, getting a college degree, running up a big $100,000, $200,000 debt to go to college. And they come out with a communications degree or a business degree or something that's not specific enough to really guarantee that they're likely to get a job, like if you took up computer programming or engineering or something like that, or even medicine. So what we have now is we have no tradespeople in this country if they're not immigrants. You can see that in spades in San Diego. I've done two remodels there, and I couldn't find a tradesperson to work on my house that wasn't an immigrant.
Yeah.
And some of them are illegal immigrants. You don't know whether they're legal or not based on the way these systems, these little companies pop up and bid jobs and come in and do different jobs. But we sure as heck don't have any of our kids in there from the traditional American school system that knew trades and went into the trades business.
Yeah,
there's a great editorial in the Wall Street Journal this morning about talking about, if we really want to build infrastructure, let's build some shipyards. Because, you know, we just, over the last 50 years, we've just decimated our shipyards to the point, I think we've got, what, three major ones. But if the Navy really wants to build 300 ship Navy or 400 ship Navy, we'll never get there. So, and I think of pipe fitters and,
exactly.
$25 an hour, and you know, they get pressured to lower it to $20 an hour and things like that.
They're having that problem in spades with a new submarine, the Columbia class submarine that they're trying to build. They can't find tradespeople up in Groton to build those submarines. And while you're talking about submarines, let's maybe just bring up one other point. So the NASCO shipyard right there in San Diego, I was in that shipyard with the Navy Research Advisory Council team several years ago. This has probably been 6 years ago now. And they had brought in Hyundai shipyard people to teach them how to be more productive in the shipyard. And they radically changed the way the ships were built in that shipyard. And they were proud because they were getting some of the metrics for how fast they could do the ship jobs to improve a lot. But in the process of learning that, I learned that at the time, and I assume it's still true, Hyundai Shipyard produced over 250 large tanker ships or cargo ships in 1 year. So if you think about that, they're producing a cargo ship in a day and a half or a day and a third, right? And pumping them out there and pushing them out onto the oceans to provide the oil and the cargo that we all enjoy every day coming through the seaways, which gets us back to the Pacific and why we carry about whether or not we can continue to keep the sea lanes open in the Pacific, which is one of the roles America has been the key player in over the decades.
That brings up another topic that you had asked me to think about, our global role, right? Where do we see the United States in this? Are we the world's police officers? Or do we want to become isolationist like we have in the past, which I think is a huge mistake? That the challenge we have being the world's police officers, the mistakes we make with not understanding the world, right? So we've been in quagmires before, right? 10 plus year wars because we don't understand what we're doing, right? So what do you guys think about that challenge that we have? And this involves all the topics we've discussed, our leadership, not being aware of the world and bad policy. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a good point. One of my favorite authors is Victor Davis Hanson. He's a Stanford professor, history professor, but he specializes in ancient war and war in general. And he talks often about the fact that wars are started for often small reasons that they lead to big devastating effects on the country and the countries involved. And we're potentially facing that situation again as we face China or China faces us. And typically wars are caused by younger civilizations rising and thinking that they have garnered enough power to overtake an existing civilization. And it may or may not be true, which is what gets us into these situations. But that kind of history is the kind of history that's revolutionary to the possibilities that we don't think enough about in the way we currently, as we just said, don't think very much about our history or about the histories of the planet.
Right. Yeah, I think Admiral James Trevise's new book, which came out like 2 weeks ago, 2034, that's kind of the major discussion about young people in our military. Just, you know, sometimes it's just young people do stupid things, or they're in a situation in the South China Sea where just things happen. So that whole book is about how the war starts, right, much like how World War I started, you know, with nothing major. Let's shift a little bit to just one of the things is this Smart Futures podcast. We definitely want to create topics of interest that, you know, that the audience wants to hear about. So what are the 4 or 5 technology topics that you think down the road we should talk about, or what technology that we're going to have a major impact on the world, the country, our military? Throw that out to Ken.
Yeah. We talked about AI, most definitely a significant technology that's going to go dramatic difference in our future. Machine learning, right? Deep learning. I think coupled with that, quantum computing, I think that goes hand in hand, right? They're going to have a huge influence in our future, global future, by the way. I think this is a little different topic. I think blockchain is going to have a significant impact on how business is conducted. It may change banking as we know it. Banking as we know it may go away, right? We're going to need to think about how we're going to deal with monetization and exchange in the future, right? That's a huge challenge. Marv, do you have any others you want to add to that list?
Well, I was glad you brought up the blockchain, because I was going to bring it up. I think actually the horse is out of the barn too far to put it back in, because here's an interesting discussion for the people who don't quite understand blockchain. Blockchain is about keeping all the transaction records of something like, in the case of Bitcoin, buying a Bitcoin and putting your money on the line to buy it. And that transaction is captured in an encrypted series of blocks, and each block has a encryption key to go with it for all the previous blocks. So the only way you can break open a block is if you can break open all the previous blocks to figure out how to get that last encryption code. And because of that, Bitcoin, as by a bunch group of very smart people, or a smart person, if that's what it is, has created a situation now that is running away in our financial system in such a way that it could replace fiat currencies or government-controlled currencies. So in other words, if you think about a future world that does not have its primary financial activities governed by any government, that's a radical difference, right? And you know that governments are not going to absorb that idea easily and without a strong fight by banning Bitcoin or doing whatever they're going to do. But that transition is well underway, and it's a big deal. And to your point about the transactions, Maersk Shipping has been working with IBM for a couple of years to put in place a blockchain ledger system for all the transactions associated with shipping. And the nice thing about a blockchain ledger system is they're all transparent. Anybody can see what happened in the ledger, but nobody can change it unless the changes are authorized by the system, the way the blockchain works. Mm-hmm. So what that would mean is you could have ledger systems that support all the transportation of goods and services around the planet without having any of the audit trail or the audit companies or the audit processes going on, because it's built into the system and the system can't be broken. So that's a radical change in the way we run the world. And it will be a big deal as it continues on over the next, I think, 5 to 10 years is going to tell us a lot about what's going to happen.
To your point, I think China has banned Bitcoin, but if I'm not mistaken, they created their own.
Great. China has created the digital yuan, which is their own blockchain, and all of their smartphone to smartphone or smartphone to device transactions, which is now more than, I just read, it's a greater amount than their current GDP in transactions. That's all done in a blockchain, but the reason they wanted to do in a blockchain is it's totally transparent to them and they can see every transaction. They're trying to force everybody into the same system because it completely makes everybody's activity transparent to them as the government, because they own the blockchain.
So the implications of that is now China can actually control it, but also you think about governments, the governments run on taxation. I need money. So if I can know every transaction, I can now tax your transactions and I get my piece of the pie, right?
So they don't even have to do that. They tax the transaction. So it's all, I might get pulled out as soon as the transaction.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of like tax, sort of like sales tax, right? Yeah.
And for those that are listening that may not be familiar with blockchain, this is an analogy, but it gives you the idea of how the transactions are linked together and follow each other. If you have a Google account and you send out mail and somebody responds and then you respond, Google keeps a transaction tracking of everything that goes on. Somewhat similar to that. So it doesn't mean there's no one in charge. No one has to be the bookkeeper for the system. It's inherent to how it works, and it's ideal for the internet. Right.
Yeah, we'll go into more detail on it. And there's a bunch of arguments about it costs too much for all the computer usage to mine the coins and make the coins transactions work and on. So it's a deep, deep technical subject, but it's one of those areas that's going to revolutionize the world. To just mention a couple, then Jim can pipe in. Robotics is going to revolutionize the world. If we actually have robotic taxis, as the people are anticipating within the next 5 to 10 years, you could have most of the trucks on the in the cities and on the roads, most of the cars in the cities and on the roads being driven by themselves, not by a driver, and being certified to support safety, which is actually much greater than human safety in cars, because these things are going to be not less fallible than we generally are. Think of all the jobs that have moved off those systems if those robots take over all of those jobs.
Oh. Yeah, UiPath went public this week, right? Crazy IPO, and I think the robotic automation software, right? And automating and turning everything into robotic systems. There's another company, Blue Prism, is kind of the leading, but that's all kind of new stuff. We're all 5G is a hot topic, but just comments on just space and the number of low Earth orbital satellites that are being launched, between SpaceX. And then today there was an announcement that Bezos and Amazon have worked out a deal with SpaceX. Just your thoughts on, we talked about Jefferson taking 30 days to learn about things. It's going to even go crazier faster. And I joke for all us Navy folks, we always hide behind the fact that a Navy has a, DIL environment, and we're different because we don't have the networks. Well, if you got Starlink satellites above you, that excuse goes away. So just some thoughts on the world of space, which.
First of all, Jim, we ought to talk about, I've been marveling about this for the last year or more. My entire career, we grew up with the cost of putting a pound of anything in space being $10,000 to $15,000 a pound. We've had multiple billion-dollar programs through the Air Force and the DoD systems to try and reduce the cost to launch, because the cost to launch is so expensive that it's driven a lot of the decisions for all the systems we have up in space to support our national security or the communication systems, et cetera. So Elon Musk comes along and says, well, you know what? I think we should do a different job building these rockets and make them reusable and make them cheaper so that we can get more weight into space. So after they've only been in business now, 10, 15 years at the most? Yeah. After 10 to 15 years, he already just won the newest NASA $2.6 billion contract to use his large new Mars launcher to take men to the moon again. And he's already launching on his the satellite, the rocket launchers that he's taken the astronauts to the space station. He's also launching all of his Starlink satellites on the order of, 30 to 100 at a time on those rockets. And then they come back down and land, as you, if anybody's been watching them, they know. He's putting up satellites right now at in the thousands of dollars a pound. And the projection is with the new Mars launcher, they're going to be $25 a pound. So when you think about going from $15,000 a pound to $25 a pound in a time period when the money's worth a lot less than it was, there's a 3 or 4x factor right there just because of the time frames. And $25 a pound is like what it costs to drive your car to the grocery store. I mean, it's crazy that we're going to put stuff into space for that. So there, to your point, Jim, we're going to have 4,000 Musk satellites up there in low Earth orbit and another, 3,500 or so. And I just read that the Chinese are building a constellation of 13,000 satellites that they're trying to put up. So we're going to have all these things up in space. Hopefully they're not going to create the space debris and run into each other and cause that devastating problem. But for communications, any place on the planet, it's not going to be a problem.
Space traffic management is going to be a hot topic.
It already is a major problem to that point, right? So I think the public would be shocked if they knew how many items are up in space now that we track, our military tracks. So to what Marv said, I don't want to brush over this issue about what would happen if there was a collision in space and the potential for catastrophic effects that could cause. What happens is it's like playing pool. When you hit a couple of balls, they all go off in directions. What happens then, right?
Or better yet, proving it. You know, there's one thought the Chinese are just going to, you know, it's like, I just accidentally bump you. Oh, I didn't mean to, yeah. But it causes, you know, turbulence and issues down the road.
Perhaps for another one of your sessions, we can have a conversation about unintended consequences. For all of these conversations we've been having, for all the technologies, there are unintended consequences. And I don't think, you know, back to that conversation about our leaders and knowledge, I don't think we do a very good job of projecting or predicting the unintended consequences. It's inherent somewhat in our medical industry, but beyond that, I don't think we do a very good job. And profitability often drives all these decisions, right? We start a company, and by the way, Elon Musk is a phenomenon, right? He seems to be a genius. Everything he touches turns to gold. But there's unintended consequences. As you saw recently, somebody misused one of his cars, and there was an accident, and they died. The public probably is not aware that they were not following the instructions from Tesla, but nonetheless, unintended consequence, right? So yep. To Marv's point earlier, what happens when all of these truck drivers don't have a job anymore, right? We could potentially be ruining whole industries that employ people. What does the human race do at that point when robots are doing everything for us and thinking for us because we have AI, right?
So we're coming up on the end of our first podcast. And so Ken, maybe in 30 seconds to a minute, thoughts on the past year, thoughts on, you know, the next few months, but totally appreciate you joining us today. And, you know, we'll get you our gift prize. We're still trying to figure that out, but it'll be something to hang up on behind you there.
Oh, yeah. All right. So the blank wall, no gold watch though, huh?
No.
So Obviously, the topic that would most come to mind when we talk about the past year was the pandemic, right? I don't know if this is where you wanted this conversation to go, but our lack of what the pandemic was all about and our priorities and how we're treating it and in the fear mongering that's going on concerns me, right? Statistically, whether we like it or not, statistically, and a lot of people are maybe find it shameful, it's always a shame when someone dies from a disease or an infection. But statistically, the pandemic was not significant in the world population. The you know, we hear about all this fear mongering going on, and there's certain individuals in the public domain who keep saying that we need to be worried about the pandemic wiping out the Earth's population. It there's no evidence to suggest that that's ever going to happen. Pandemics are awful, they are, but we still have 7.8 billion people on this planet, and I think the number of deaths globally came to 0.0002% of the global population.
Yeah, just a related shift. Do you agree that it's, you know, in a weird way, it's kind of been good for the Defense Department because it's kind of accelerated them digitizing and, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, I used to say that the DoD was kind of behind the commercial world in processes and technology. And, you know, if anything, you know, I joke, the Navy's going to Office 365 faster. They've learned what Zoom and Teams are. So, it seems like it's been a, you know, that's the good out of this craziness.
Yeah. So we recently, my company recently got ISO 27001 certification. And one of the main takeaways, and I was the management rep that put it in place, the main takeaways is risk-based thinking, right? So, you have to plan ahead, projecting what the risks are going to be. I think we learned a lot about how to adapt if another pandemic were to come along. We're still doing it now. So teleworking, right? And teleworking is enabled by all those technologies you just mentioned, Jim, right?
Yeah.
So having Office 365, not being tethered to a on-premises data center, right? I think that's the takeaway from the military perspective and business for that matter. Be prepared. How does your workforce behave? How do I enable my workforce through technology for the next one?
Yeah. And one of our future podcasts is actually this idea of distributed work, and we're not going back to the old way, even though there'll be some cultural, you know, people that want everybody to go back to work, but all the surveys show that, you know, 50 to 70% of the employees like what they're doing and want to have this, option to either go into the office and or not. So thanks, Ken. Totally appreciate it. We'll definitely have you back. And
let me just add before you jump off, Jim, because I wanted to talk about the pandemic in a slightly different regard. I agree with what you were saying on both sides. It's been overhyped in many regards. And it has caused a lot of changes that are positive in the sense of information technology, productivity, allowances that cause us to don't have to travel as much and not have to be in the office as much. But the other thing that's interesting that we haven't touched on is these COVID vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines, which is a new form of gene editing. So, if it weren't for this COVID disease, these vaccines would have never seen the light of day, certainly as fast as they're seeing them. We still are yet to not know everything about them and what the potential impacts on the people longer term could be. But no matter what, they're ushering in new gene editing technologies that are going to help affect our health in a positive way going down the road. And that's just one of the silver linings that pops out of some of these crazy kinds of things like this. So we'll have to talk more about that in the future. And yeah, and I do thank you, Ken, for joining us today. It's been very interesting, as it always is with you.
I appreciate that, Mark. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Okay, everybody. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
All right. Later.